Chapter 7, A Bumpy Ride. When I was about 11, I remember telling a friend, "I know my mom isn't beautiful." The statement was made with apparent conviction, but in truth, it was just a searching attempt to come to grips with that age-old problem. Is my mother a woman like other women? What sort of woman is she compared with others? Could my mother truly be a sexual being? Looking at old photographs now, it's clear I was an ignorant Philistine. Mum exhibited a clear and confident sense of style when she was given the chance to dress up a little. But in my defense, she rarely got that chance, at least when we were kids, and her brand of quiet taste was not the kind an oblivious young lad would perceive anyway. Perhaps I thought beautiful meant Marilyn Monroe. Mum was a little more Shirley MacLaine. If Shirley had spent 11 hours a day chasing a gang of hyperactive juveniles in between bouts of scullery work. Mum could never be called hard-looking, but neither was she soft. Her mouth often had a grim set, and she was not quick to smile. She wasn't curvy. Never had the spare poundage for that. For all the times we went to the beach, I recall seeing her in a bathing suit once. Mum took to water like a cat. Perhaps my opinion was a reflection of Mum's general demeanor. She was no giggling flirt. Nor was she the romantic of the family firm. That, for sure, was Dad. If there was a sentimental tale to be told of their courtship or early married life, it came from Dad. And it usually wouldn't get far. Like a cheerleader at a chess match, Dad would find he was not getting a lot of support from the gallery. Mum would get a sort of a dryly withering look before bringing up some detail Dad had omitted. Some telling point that cast a new light on the story and left poor Dad looking like a puppy whose gaze has just been directed to a new carpet stain. There were plenty of carpet stains to point to. This was a man who would show disapproval of his bride's wedding gown. "I didn't mean to," Dad explained frequently. "I was just shocked. I must have had this look on my face." Must have. It was definitely noted by its target, a bride who was being punished for being slightly ahead of her time. Joan was in fact wearing a very stylish dress, not quite ankle length, with no train, very modern. As it turned out, too hip for the room. We got pictures of that dress, although just barely. No one ever got around to making copies of the official wedding photos. The only pics in the family album have proof stamped on them. The lost engagement ring. The stunned wedding gown reaction, the never-ordered photos. There is, hanging about the entire Burgess-Lawrence wedding, a whiff of disaster. The couple was married at Robertson United Church in Edmonton. The groom was 25, the bride 24, a mature couple by the standards of the time. The resumption of classes at Queen's precluded any immediate honeymoon. They would take a train back to Ottawa to visit with Bill's family, arriving New Year's Day. Here again, trouble. Bill and Joan caught a train from Edmonton down to Calgary, where they would pick up the main line headed east. But their train was cancelled. The railroad made arrangements for the newlyweds to get home on the only transport available. A troop train. Joan Burgess, née Slorence, would be the only woman on board. Their sleeping quarters were open for all to see, and many did. Our brave boys in uniform, filing past to leer at the only double X chromosome on board. Finally, a kindly porter put up a curtain to protect their privacy. Shortly afterward, the conductor took it down. "You didn't pay for that," he explained. And so the peep show went on until Ottawa. "I was on the top bunk reading Great Expectations," Dad recalls. I could hear Joan crying softly in her bunk. When you're newlyweds and your bride is crying, you know it's not going well. They were met in Ottawa by some of Bill's old buddies, none of whom Joan knew. Afterward, she still didn't know them sober. It was, after all, early on New Year's Day. At the Burgess family home, the couple was installed in Bill's old room. Altered circumstances that did not escape the attention of a very sharp young niece.
"Who's that sleeping with Uncle Bill?"
the little girl yelled down the stairs. Several days into the new enterprise, and so far, not a single warm and fuzzy tale destined to delight future generations. Their first flat in Kingston seemed decent enough, until Joan discovered the lack of running water. Water had to be hauled to the kitchen from the bathroom down the hall, which was shared with the landlady. Here were all the character-building qualities of pioneer life, with the advantages of the city, including entertainment. Home alone one day, Joan was startled by strange noises. They seemed to be coming from the basement, a cacophony of shouting and percussion pouring out the floor vents. The landlady's son was using the place to hold regular revival meetings. Joan wouldn't be home alone for long. Almost immediately after returning to Queens, Bill realized something was wrong. He could hardly climb the staircase. "Of course, my classmates were all bugging me. Look at that, married 2 weeks and can't even make it up the stairs. Ain't love grand?" It wasn't love. It was rheumatic fever. Bill would not be the first groom to spend the first month of wedded bliss in bed weak as a kitten. Joan would not be the first young bride to be asked to play nurse. But it's supposed to be more fun. Those still may have been happy times. Anecdotal evidence from other newlyweds suggests that troubles are more easily borne at that novel and exciting early stage of domestic life. Dad certainly remembers the period fondly. But that's the tricky thing about early Burgess family stories. Coming from Dad, they are happy. Mum's state of mind is always harder to determine. She'd come through a lot of changes quickly. She had gone to Queens as a prospective business student and discovered instead a love of English literature. Pulled back into her mother's orbit, she had finally returned to Queens and rekindled a lost love. Now she was the young bride of a soon-to-be-ordained United Church minister. Perhaps Mum's later stories of that time were colored by her retroactive knowledge of what was coming. Life as a small-town minister's wife, and a new role as a human production line with an output that would shame Henry Ford. Academic life would soon seem very far away. In 1951, the Reverend Bill Burgess received his first pastoral charge as an ordained minister. Chicago and New York were apparently unavailable. He got Stoughton, a town of roughly 500,000 souls in the southeastern quadrant of Saskatchewan. Stoughton in the 1950s was the picture of a bygone age. The wide main street with its tidy little storefronts, grain elevators, fields of golden wheat, and key parties. Later immortalized in the book and film The Ice Storm, both set in 1970s America, key parties involved groups of married couples who throw their keys into a bowl. Keys are fished out at random to create new couples who then repair to private bedrooms. In Little Stoughton, 5 years before the publication of Peyton Place, and with the 70s still a far-off version of space-age jumpsuits and flying cars, folks were apparently rather ahead of their time. The doctor who lived across the street with his lovely wife was involved, Dad said later. I think I briefly considered preaching a sermon about it. Stoughton key parties must have suffered obvious disadvantages when compared with similar gatherings in, say, Indianapolis. The population at the time could not have been much more than 500. Subtract the kids, the old, and the happily incurious, and you're not left with much of a talent pool. It is arguably one of the perks of being the local minister that you would get no invitations to such events. Shortly after the young married set up house, Bill's father Joe and sister Belle paid a visit. As a senior bureaucrat in charge of dairy production, Joe Burgess was like a king moving among his subjects. He was eager to visit a nearby farm. On arrival, they were greeted with a pan of disinfectant. There had been a local outbreak of hoof and mouth disease. Joe Burgess stepped out of the pan, shook the drops of disinfectant from his boots, and muttered to his son, "They sure are suspicious of government people out here." As for Belle, she toured the family home and summed up the locale with a realtor's eye. "Every window I look out," she said, "there's an outhouse." Small farming towns are close-knit places. Paradise lost, according to Thornton Wilder and John Mellencamp. Hell if you have the wrong neighbors. There's a point at which neighborly concern crosses the line into outright criminality. The Burgess family lived next door to a woman named Maud. Maud headed the manse committee, which oversaw matters concerning the house the Burgesses now occupied with their first child, little Joey, born in 1952. United Church ministers' families lived in church-supplied housing, an important perk considering the modest salary, but in practice, rather like the experience of poor orphans living on the charity of rich relatives. The manse committee had jurisdiction over all decisions concerning the house, even down to Joan's request to purchase a cover for a ratty old couch. Denied. Maudie took her responsibilities seriously. This is how seriously. Once when Bill and Joan went on vacation, Maud took the liberty of letting herself into the manse. There she found that new linoleum had recently been laid in the kitchen. To Maudie, it was an abomination. An exorcism was required, the Protestant kind. Maud cast out the new linoleum and replaced it with a variety more to her liking. And so, the kitchen was cleansed and made whole. No thanks necessary. Maud was just doing her job. A measure of vengeance would eventually come, served up small-town style, all white and fluffy. For local women, the social yardsticks of that time and place were domestic, a series of deceptively competitive displays of household competence. The brightest victory flags of all were the flapping lines of wash hung out on the line Monday morning, clean, fresh, and best of all, first. Monday was wash day, just as surely as Sunday was the sacred Sabbath when no work could be done. Battle was not to be joined until Monday. The woman whose laundry appeared first on Monday morning was clearly a Stoughton Floyd Patterson, a household heavyweight champ. That tended to be Maud. It sure wasn't Mum. A small-town minister's spouse is the local Caesar's wife, expected to be a shining example of all things good and decent. Joan did possess some useful traits for the role. She was quiet and circumspect. But it was a role she never felt up to. A new mother, intensely private, uncomfortably analytical, and lacking in glib self-confidence, she was unsure of the domestic skills that she knew would be the basis of her reputation with many townsfolk. Her strong points must have seemed as useless as good penmanship in a fistfight. And every Monday morning, she had Maud's wash slapping her in the face. A weekly reminder of her own perceived shortcomings as a housekeeper. One Sunday night, on his way back from church, Dad decided to hop the backyard fence, intending to check in with Maud and her husband about some manse-related issue. Looking through the back screen door, he caught sight of Maud's husband. He was busy separating and soaking the laundry, getting a head start on tomorrow's assault. On the sacred Sabbath, no less.
"It's the minister!" Maud shrieked.
Too late. Busted. Talk about dirty laundry. Old Maud was a wash day cheat. The stain of sin was on her queen-size sheets and sensible undergarments. The tale of her downfall would become a revered chapter in the Burgess oral history. By 1954, Lynn had been born. Bill's father died that year, shortly after his youngest son made it back to Ottawa to see him one last time. "I came into the hospital room and he asked me to read the sports section to him," Dad said. None of the five kids would have personal memories of Grandpa Joe. The growing Burgess family moved 25 miles away to Fillmore, Saskatchewan, there to grow some more. Brother Jock was born in 55, three kids now, although one day it went back to two. Dad ministered to all the churches in the area, so we knew all the farmers, Joe says. I was probably four. I think this was the summer of 1957. We were at a picnic at a prairie lake near Fillmore. I had to take a dump. Dad told me to go to the outhouse. Between where we were and the outhouse was this major cloud of mosquitoes. It seemed to me that he was trying to kill me. Joe went about halfway and stopped, dropping his shorts in the open air. There was no escaping the steaming evidence of his disobedience. "The only thing to do now," he recalls, "was run. I ran behind a parked car and peered around at the group, then to the next car, then out to the road. We were in the country, so all the roads were straight, intersected by other roads in a patchwork system that connected all the farms. I set out. Eventually, I came to a crossroad and turned right. I trudged along, and after a while I started to cry. But what choice did I have? The sun was going down, so it was late. I'd been gone 4 or 5 hours at least. There was a farm coming up on my left, and I decided I was going to spend the night under a big tree in the front yard. Then I saw this car racing up a side road, and then another came over a rise behind me. They'd seen my footprints in the dirt and were following them. I will always remember Mum's face when they brought me back and put me in her arms, red and streaked from crying. She was sobbing. She just held on to me so tight. I don't have any memory of being punished. I heard later, Joe says, that they'd been getting ready to drag the lake. Leslie was born in 1957. It was this fourth baby bulge that drew Grandma's infamous epithet, spat out in the driveway, "Not again!" Mum would always describe this as the most difficult of her five pregnancies. It was not planned. She was stressed and sick. Mum used to actually lose weight after a pregnancy, Lynn says. She gained less weight than the baby and fluid weighed, so she ended up weighing less afterwards than she had at the outset. We sucked every bit of fat out of her body. Joan knew the pregnancy would be unpopular with her mother, and added to the pressure of Grandma's disapproval was the knowledge that the already strained family finances would now be stretched like gum on a hot sidewalk. She felt it was only responsible to consider the options. In her doctor's office, she explained the circumstances, reviewed the arguments. He asked her a simple question. "What do you want to do?" "I want to have the baby," she said. There are many battles in a war for independence. Perhaps final victory can never be declared. But this one was big. Telling the story later, Mum would say, "All the stress and uncertainty went away. It all became clear as soon as I answered." So clear, in fact, that she was not even displeased when it all happened again the following year. Not even when the nurse took one look at scrawny, scratchy baby number 5 and announced, "Only a mother could love this one." She did. I never had a moment's doubt about that. Although they wisely kept me away from mirrors in the early years. Born without physical beauty, I did possess a quality my siblings lacked: the constitutional right to become President of the United States. A month before my birth, the family had taken up residence in Collins, Ohio, while Dad pursued a master's degree at the Oberlin Graduate School of Theology. I was born a Canadian Yankee in the Fisher Titus Hospital in Norwalk, Ohio. In that pre-environmentalism era, the town was often described as sitting just outside the smell of Lake Erie. Norwalk would later lend its name to the renowned virus, popular on cruise ships. I imagine there's a sign as you drive in. The family was now complete. Mum made sure of that. Someone at Fisher Titus had told her about an operation for men, and Dad dutifully checked in the very next week. I would be the last happy accident ever to get a meal ticket at the Burgess house. Collins was tiny. The Burgess block alone had the electoral muscle to take over the mayor's office, had it not been for our eligibility issues. Dad put himself through school, serving as minister in the local Methodist church, working on his degree during the week. I think I was so focused on what I had to do for school that I didn't really stop to think about the job Joan was doing, he said later. Others were keeping a closer watch. Neighbors Bob and Martha lived about 100 yards up the street, with a clear view of our big red cedar-shingled church manse. One summer night, Martha saw the lights burning late at Casa Burgess and knew that whatever was going on, it was preventing poor young Joan from a good night's sleep. Next morning, she showed up at the door and announced she was taking the older kids to the county fair in Norwalk. Not every small town was claustrophobic. Not every neighbor was Maud. One winter night, another neighbor named Ross, paying an after-dinner call, was stunned to see 18-month-old Leslie being put to bed wearing a snowsuit. It was a necessity, Joan explained. The old mansion was heated by an antique coal furnace that blew all its heat through a single large vent located at the base of the stairs. If the vent represented our sun, the upstairs bedrooms would be Saturn, Neptune, and Pluto. At the next meeting of the Church Volunteers Committee, Ross got busy knocking heads together. Renovations commenced shortly. Our neighbors on one side were Jim and Audrey, until their house burned down. Even as firemen were chopping holes in the roof, Audrey was in our kitchen, hysterical. "The firemen are going upstairs," she told Mum. "The beds aren't made. I didn't get the chance to clean." Paramedics gave her a tranquilizer shot. Just then, the school bus turned into the street. 5-year-old Lynn was arriving home. Seeing the blazing house, she rushed to the front of the bus. "Stop," she told the driver. "Let me off.
I'm a member of the Smokey the Bear Club!
It was true. Mum had allowed her to join that august society for kids who wished to prevent forest fires. The circumstances here were not precisely as specified in club rules. No bears were in peril. But it was a genuine five-star conflagration. And that's what all the weeks of instruction are about. The driver let me off, too, Lynn says. Not surprising. This was Little Grandma in action, a fearsome force, even in miniature. And the yards were huge on our street, so stopping at the neighbor's house meant dropping the bossy little tyke quite a long way from home. However, this potentially heroic intervention would be thwarted. Mum wouldn't let me go help. I was mad.
What is the point of being in the Smokey the Bear Club if you're not allowed to fight fires?
Our American dream lasted only a couple of years. In 1960, the first American advisors were already in Vietnam, and I had that American birth certificate. No doubt sensing the return of the draft, I was anxious to get my diapered ass back to Canada. Luckily, Dad now had his degree, and a posting back in Saskatchewan, at the Regina Field Office of the United Church. Chapter 8. Regina. Regina takes a lot of knocks. Flat as pea on a plate, my friend Tom says. Never once described as the Paris of the prairies. Jan Arden once called it, the town that rhymes with fun. Locals say you can watch your dog run away for a week. But a hometown is like a religion. Get it into a child's head early, and you bypass the critical faculties. Sights seen with young eyes will always hold special wonder. Let New York sophisticates sneer how they will. 4 out of 5 Burgess kids considered Regina a land of enchantment. At least 50% of our parents felt the same. We would spend 5 years there, formative years, and not just for Burgesses. When we arrived, John F. Kennedy was still a presidential candidate, and for the first few years, the radio played Frank and Dean and a lot of guys named Bobby. By the time we left Saskatchewan, the province had become a test case for socialized medicine. U.S. Marines had landed in Da Nang, and at least one of the kids owned a beetle wig. Our salmon-pink bungalow sat on a street full of young families out near the edge of town. Joe's confectionery was at the end of the block. A block or two beyond that, the sidewalk stopped abruptly, and you stepped off into open prairie. As our mother had done in 1930s Bassano, we were free to roam the plains. Pack a little lunch, stop in at Joe's for a 2-cent paper bag of assorted candy, sugar peanuts, scotch mints, caramels, and you were on safari. Grasslands, hillocks, gullies, and trees, though not too many of the last, just enough to provide the occasional shady oasis, not enough to crowd or oppress or interfere with the high white-flecked sky. Brown and white buses shaped like loaves of bread motored past our house, trailing blue fog. Nothing takes me back to that time like the smell of diesel fumes. Our street was lined with Chevy Bel Airs, Ford Falcons, and AMC Ramblers, two-toned beauties with chrome and plush, and nary a buckle or harness to prevent your sudden launch through the windshield and under the hood. Let Ralph Nader complain all he likes. At least by that time, hood ornaments were being phased out, which made for safer landings. We lived at 5320 2nd Avenue. Sing it! We did. Mum and Dad made a little jingle out of our home address, so we'd remember it if we ever got lost. Or if our parents ever tried to abandon us at a public swimming pool and sneak away. But to be fair, that only happened once. It was an honest mistake, they insist. Certainly there was no shortage of us, and small details can be easy to miss. The evidence is in the family photo albums. Other kids got individual snapshots, but after a while the novelty wears off and film is expensive. Me? I'm in a few crowd scenes. So one day, when I was 3 or 4 years old, the family was at the local public swimming pool. The hour got late. I must have dawdled while everyone else was piling into the car. The result formed one of my earliest memories, watching the teardrop taillights on our burgundy Chevy station wagon recede down the street as I stood on the sidewalk, dripping. Cool in a crisis, I went straight to a security guard and announced myself as a lost boy. I knew our phone number and sang our address. "What's your name?" the man asked as he dialed. "William," I replied. This was technically correct. William is in fact my first name. though everyone called me by my second. As a young man, Dad always loathed being called Billy and didn't want the same for his own son, so I became Steve. But now I was dealing with a man in uniform, and it seemed to me formality was called for. My first name was more official, and that's the one I gave. Thus the unfortunate moment when Dad answered the phone and the security guard asked whether he had a son named William. "No," said Dad. "No, I don't." Suddenly it began to look like this abandonment had been no accident. The guard looked at me, perhaps wondering what my little game might be. I didn't know what else to tell him. Happily, before hanging up, Dad took the opportunity to count noses. Panic ensued. The Bel Air belched fire as I was hurriedly retrieved. Stammered explanations were offered to pool staff. I don't recall whether we ever went back. It's likely that our photos were posted on the security office wall just in case. In 1960, the five Burgess children ranged in age from 7 years to 18 months. That roiling mass of tadpoles was hard enough to manage even when two were watching. Most of the time it was only Mum. Dad's duties at the United Church field office meant a lot of travel, training, and seminars. There was very little spare money for babysitters. It helped some that we were easily bribed. Since Mum was forced to take us all along on shopping trips to the White Rose supermarket, she would lay down the rules beforehand. If everyone behaves, you get animal crackers. Powerful incentive in those straitened times. A family friend recalls, "You kids all followed behind like baby ducks." For crackers. We were non-union. Animal-shaped perks were not always sufficient. The prevailing attitude towards corporal punishment was different in the early 60s. A good spanking was generally considered a legitimate arrow in the parental quiver. We didn't get a lot of them, but the threat was there. Like this: "If I have to stop this car, I don't care who I hit." That essential unfairness was key to the deterrent factor. Once the furies were unleashed, it was understood that the consequences were unpredictable. "Straighten up and fly right," Mum would bark. A classic. Dad had the advantage of novelty. We didn't see him often enough to get tired of him. "I remember driving home from a conference once," he says. "I'd been away for about a week. There was a romantic song on the radio, and I was singing along and dreaming about Joan and looking forward to being alone. Then I drove up, and a couple of you kids ran out to argue about something, and I could see Joan behind holding another one, looking very harassed, and my little daydream was over." Once, while attending a lengthy conference in Saskatoon, he phoned home to check in. "Are you coming back soon?" Mum asked. A few days later, he answered. "Everything okay?" "Well," she said, "I've come down with something, so I've been spending a lot of time lying on the couch. Also, Lynn got hit by a car." He was on the highway in less than an hour. Lynn wasn't seriously hurt. Dad's conscience was bleeding profusely. Even when Dad was home, he wasn't always present. Dad read a lot and had the reader's ability to focus intently. The kids would wait till he was deep in that faraway zone and take the opportunity to ask for stuff. "Mm-hmm," he would murmur, and his assent to a sleepover or camping trip or increase in allowance would immediately be reported to Mum, who as a rule was not fooled. This little routine almost led to disaster. Eldest brother Joe had begun sleepwalking regularly. One winter night, he came padding down the stairs, stark naked, and stood beside Dad's rocking chair. "I'm going out," Joe said. "Mm-hmm," Dad replied. Joe actually had the front door open and was stepping into a prairie snowstorm by the time Dad emerged from his book fog and grasped the situation. It may be a little unfair to stand that anecdote up as a metaphor for Dad's general situation, floating somewhere high above the domestic grind. Not too unfair, though. Mum was carrying the load. She was like Hercules, cleaning the Augean stables week after week with little help. But she did not see a hero in the mirror. There always seemed to be a domestic nemesis nearby to torment her. In Regina, it was our next-door neighbor, Mrs. Dice. She kept a spotless home with a garden and always had the wash out early. Mrs. Dice had one son. But Mum didn't really consider that aspect. She saw only her own struggles, felt her own failures. Yet the issues Mum faced were astounding. They ranged from the mundane, illness, injury, to the thoroughly odd, like headbanging. While still preschoolers, my sister Leslie and I both developed the habit of sitting with our backs to the wall, rhythmically banging our heads. I don't recall how it started, but I do remember it was pleasantly numbing. If no one had ever invented alcohol, a lot of folks would be doing it. Today there's help and reassurance a click away. The website mamashealth.com explains kids who are understimulated, those who are blind, deaf, bored, or lonely, headbang for stimulation. Children who are overstimulated, in an overwhelming environment, find the rhythmic movements of headbanging soothing. Headbanging may be a symptom of autism, Tourette's syndrome, and seizure disorders. Mum would have loved the internet in 1962. The bungalow at 5320 2nd Avenue may as well have been an island. Alcatraz. As it turned out, neither Leslie nor I suffered from autism or seizure disorders or was deaf except when convenient. We were competitive, though. Eventually, we both banged holes right through the drywall, each racing to be first to break through. Leslie won, but then I dropped her special Donald Duck bubble bath down one of the holes. Always something. Kids don't think about a mother's insecurities, and it is a mark of Mum's success that we were so blissfully ignorant. Nor was Mum completely lacking in perspective. She was as fond as anyone of mining good family stories from domestic problems. One epic tale involved my potty training. As I seem to recall from Shakespeare, bubble, bubble, toilet trouble. The first time they lowered me over that gaping whirlpool whose victims are never again seen, things did not go well. A tender fold of bum skin caught the edge of the booster seat. "It bit me!" I howled. It was every mother's nightmare scenario. I wasn't going near that shark tank ever again. I was afraid of things that bit. Pine cones. Yes, they did, on the foot. Toilets, pine cones, and spiders. One of these can still make me soil myself today. If there's a large spider beside the toilet, I would rather use Depends. But as for the specific toilet phobia, mark it down as conquered. I was 4 years old the day I wandered into the kitchen while Mum was doing dishes. "Well," I said, "guess I'll go potty." Mum tried to keep her voice casual. "Do you want me to help?" "Nope," I replied. "But you can come and keep me company if you want." Perhaps I'd been parking logs in my drawers just to get some one-on-one Mum time. Not easy to do with all the little lobbyists running around the house. Competition for an appointment was fierce. That's why I so cherished that special year when all the kids were in school save me. My turn came eventually, though. I would be forced to bid my mother goodbye and make the long parka-clad waddle down the street and up the lane to Rosemont Elementary. Rosemont was actually only a couple of blocks from the house. Later in my youth, I would tell friends that in Saskatchewan, winter attacked with a fury unknown even in neighboring provinces. The proof? In Regina, the snow went all the way to the top of the school fence. As an adult, I would return to Regina, visit the Rosemont schoolyard, and find that the fence in question had been less than 2 feet high. It was like a brilliant little mnemonic joke played by the Regina school board. I tipped my toque to them. One of us was less than overjoyed with Regina and with Rosemont. By 1964, 11-year-old Joe was already starting grade 8. A bright student, Joe had been hustled along thanks to the then-in-vogue strategy of allowing sharper students to skip grades. Eventually, educators realized that the social drawbacks outweighed the scholastic advantages. "I had entered school a year early and then done grades 3 and 4 in the same year," Joe says. "So when I hit grade 5 in 1961, I was 8 going on 9. When I hit grade 7, I was tall, a complete beanpole, not well coordinated, and definitely out of my league in the social scene. I was being fed all these stories at school about the grope parties in the park. And being out of the popular stream, seemingly unaccomplished, I was a target. One guy who sat behind me stabbed me in the back with his compass." Nasty. But nobody was meaner than Noble Galloway. Galloway was one of Joe's classmates. Even as a kindergarten student, I was afraid of Noble Galloway. One day, during sleepy towel time, I committed a crime. I tugged on another kid's towel while he napped on it, causing him to bump his head on a table leg. For reasons I can't recall, he had it coming. My sentence, 10 minutes standing out in the hall. This was a cruel sort of Russian roulette the teachers played with us. If the principal walked down the hall during your stretch and found you standing there, you would be hauled down to the office as an official miscreant, and your parents would be called. If the principal stayed in his office during your hall sentence, you were safe. What the teachers did not understand was that the kids in the hall, while afraid of the principal, were more afraid of Noble Galloway. We were sure if he happened by, he'd kick our asses just to keep limber. Galloway was a genuine thug. I don't know how many grades he had failed along the way, but it is safe to say that by the time he hit grade 8, he did not fit into a little desk with a lot of clearance. Such was his local reign of terror that he once had a mano-a-mano showdown with my own mother. Mum was looking out the window on 2nd Avenue and saw a local thug, Galloway I assumed, dragging a boy down the street. Pausing in front of our house, he tied his victim to a telephone pole and set off on some other psychopathic errand. She came out of the house to untie the frightened kid. Moments later, Galloway was in her face. Mum stared him down. "I'm going inside to call the police," she said. Galloway took off. It's unlikely Galloway made any connection between Joe and Mum. But Galloway didn't need reasons to terrorize boys. Quite the opposite. He and his boys had a brilliantly evil little strategy. Every Monday in the Rosemont schoolyard, Galloway, or one of his cronies, would announce the name of whichever boy was going to be beaten up the following Friday. The lucky winner would then sweat through the week until X day, when his ticket would be punched. One week, inevitably, the lottery came up Joe. Mum wanted to call the school and put a stop to it. Joe begged her not to. "Please, Mum, it'll just be worse for me." Mum did not call. Friday arrived, and Joe took his beating. I remember hearing a story years later to the effect that Galloway had been shot dead during the commission of a crime. It helps me sleep. Bullying was not the issue of greatest concern to my parents. A much bigger threat would have a profound and lasting political effect on the Burgess clan. The catalyst was the Saskatchewan doctors' strike of 1962. In the summer of that year, 7-year-old Lynn became seriously ill. How ill? "We were having Jell-O chocolate pudding for dessert," Lynn recalls, "and I didn't want any." It was a case for the emergency department. We sat in the waiting room for hours. I remember looking up at the clock, one of those black and white school-type clocks with the big numbers. It was 11:30 p.m., no doctor saw me. At midnight, they sent everyone home. The nurse told Dad to bring me back in the morning. This was not normal procedure in an emergency ward, but these were not normal times for Saskatchewan healthcare. In 1962, the Canadian government-supported healthcare system did not exist. Tommy Douglas of the CCF, Cooperative Commonwealth Federation, had introduced a plan for universal medical insurance during the 1960 provincial election and won. Douglas then stepped aside to form the New Democratic Party, leaving the Medicare battle to new CCF Premier Woodrow Lloyd. After delaying for months, Lloyd finally enacted the Universal Medical Insurance Legislation scheme on July 1st. The same day, Saskatchewan doctors went on strike. Lynn had picked that very week to get sick. "The next morning I was worse," Lynn says. "I remember Dad trying to dress me as I cried. I kept telling him it hurt when I moved. We got to the Grey Nuns Hospital. They pricked my finger to take a blood sample, and I responded by throwing up on the floor." It was explained that Lynn would have to be left at the hospital. However, the strike meant that there would be no information available concerning her condition. Our family doctor had offered an opinion before commencing strike action, though. He thought I had one of two disorders. One was chronic, and the other was terminal. Finding out which would have to wait, for the end of the strike or of Lynn. That night in the ward, Lynn was feverish. The girls in my room were running around having a pillow fight. I kept pressing the call button for the nurse, but no one came. Finally, in desperation, I got out of bed and went into the hall. All the nurses were huddled around a radio listening for news of the strike negotiations. I walked toward them, and not one of them turned around or noticed me. Just when I got to the nurses' station, I threw up all over the floor. That got their attention. 10 days later, Lynn was not dead. Nor was she much better. They released her anyway. Mum told me later she was furious. They had to take me back to the hospital, this time to the general. Our doctor was apologetic, but he had not been allowed to communicate with the family during the strike. The virulent anti-government campaign, supported by the Regina Leader Post and the American Medical Association, was finally countered by voices from outside the province, including British and European doctors brought in by the Saskatchewan government, who argued that universal medical insurance was not, in fact, a shortcut to Soviet tyranny. An end to the strike was negotiated after 23 days. Medicare had pulled through. So had Lynn. My parents, however, had caught a new virus from which they would never recover. Previous to that month, they had merely leaned toward the New Democrats. Afterward, their political convictions would become more pronounced. Lynn's near-death experience had a silver lining. Like me and my clever pants-soiling routine, she had inadvertently stumbled upon a strategy. I used to love going to the hospital because Mum would come to visit me, and only me. I felt special. My kidneys were inflamed and the condition was chronic. I was hospitalized 3 times between the ages of 7 and 9. She'd go to the cafeteria and get me a bag of cheesies or bring me a comic book. What's not to like? Mum would probably have had to take the bus to the hospital, would have had to hire a sitter. Dad never came, so I expect he was traveling and had the car. I remember how happy I was to see her and how special I felt because I didn't have to share her. After I got out, I added a phrase to my bedtime prayers. I'd pray, "Please God, let me go to the hospital." When Mum heard Lynn's prayer, she misinterpreted its meaning. She thought it meant I wasn't happy at home. Tolstoy wrote, "Happy families are all alike." It makes you wonder if he knew any. They're not. They're not even all happy, at least not all the time. Was 5320 2nd Avenue a happy home? Most inmates thought so. Every domestic realm has its particular rhythms. To some extent, ours were a matter of numbers. 5 kids, and most days a single parent, meant that a lot of our shaping influences were not top-down, but lateral. In large families, kids tend to raise each other. Older kids take on the roles of middle management, sub-parents delegated to handle cultural and behavioral instruction. Eldest brother Joe ran middle brother Jock with an iron hand and something of a cruel streak. He had the Lucy and Charlie Brown habit of staging various athletic contests, which Jock would be allowed to almost win. Lynn was the real Lucy. Lynn could have eaten Lucy for breakfast. Her primary job was to dominate Leslie. But the task left her plenty of spare time and energy to command the rest of us, a task she performed with the ferocity of Nurse Ratched. My direct overseer was Jock. Although Joe had been rough on Jock, Jock proved happily to be a more benevolent tyrant. We lived a rich and productive fantasy life. At night, we swam beneath the covers of our beds pretending to be sea turtles. By day, we recorded rock albums on an old reel-to-reel tape recorder. I played an apple box drum with plastic bowling pin sticks. All original material. We created a comic book series in which different beings inhabited each of the 9 planets. In those innocent days, Pluto still enjoyed planetary status. Neptunians had figure-eight feet and a single eye set in the middle of a large X that crossed their balloon-like heads. They were mean bastards. Mercurians had oval heads and no legs at all. No need, thanks to the jet propulsion system built right into their floating abdomens. A peaceful race, the Mercurians, unless pushed. The influence of an older brother, even a benevolent one, can be hard to shake. For years, I would not permit myself to form an opinion about a song or a group until I knew what Jock thought. Some years later, at last, came the insurrection. I grabbed a catalog from the Record Club of Canada, we were members with absolutely no obligation, and flipped through it randomly. One picture showed a bunch of guys standing in front of some kind of blimp. "I'm ordering that one," I announced. Jock did not approve. Perfect. Led Zeppelin II went on to become a favorite of mine for quite a while. The family always ate dinner together. Discussion was encouraged, if indeed encouragement was needed. Maintaining silence would have required a high-pressure hose. Not that we were constantly engaged in musings about American foreign policy. More often it was about annoying your siblings. Jock was what they used to call, in those less clinical days, fussy. Had our parents been psychiatrists, Lynn would have come up with at least three rhyming taunts employing the phrase obsessive-compulsive. Jock would not eat mashed potatoes with lumps in them. He had something close to a phobia about wet bread. In some school hygiene class, he had heard that for optimum digestion, one must chew each bite of food 32 times. So he did. Lynn would sit beside him and count aloud. "Mom!" Jock would yell. "Make her stop!" In the end, the food was properly chewed and the chewer properly aggravated. It was a true symbiotic relationship. The rest of the world seemed to think Joan and Bill Burgess were doing a pretty fine job. Both parents were active in the St. John's Sunday School, where their projects included getting the kids to write a Jerusalem newspaper, reporting on the current civil rights movement from a gospel perspective. As we prepared to leave town in 1965, a St. John's United volunteer named Art Cato wrote a farewell tribute. "When my thoughts come to the kingdom of God," he wrote, "I often visualize the Burgess family. Early Sunday mornings when their white station wagon drove up," we had traded the Chev for a Ford, "full of children, and Bill and Joan carrying armfuls of books and gadgets to work as team teachers, and they would all flock into the side door of our church. It was as if the kingdom of God was moving in on us." High praise, that. But for Mum, sometimes it must have felt more like the apocalypse. She may have been the only one in the neighborhood likely to accuse Joan Burgess of being a bad mother. Many years later, I would get a glimpse of her true emotional state during the Regina days. In the early 1980s, while I was working as a DJ at a Regina radio station, my parents came from Brandon to visit. Dad and I got excited about visiting the old pink house on 2nd Avenue. Mum was less enthusiastic. While Dad and I talked our way in for a look around, she waited in the car. We rambled through the place, exclaiming at familiar sights and enjoying ourselves thoroughly. Later over dinner, Mum confessed, "The sight of that house made me feel physically ill." There were occasions when even we oblivious kids caught a glimpse of Mum's internal turmoil. Among the most famous, the pressure cooker incident. It was Mum's birthday. Dad sat by proudly while she unwrapped her annual gift, something Dad and the kids had seen in a shop window looking very pretty, perfect for our mother. Whatever celebration we might have planned would have been sincere and enthusiastic, but five kids under the age of 13 do not allow for anything truly resembling a day off, so if there was a cake, Mum probably baked it. Now she received her husband's token of affection, a shiny new pressure cooker. Mum received the gift graciously at first, but contents under pressure can sometimes blow. A few hours later, her frustration exploded. "A pressure cooker," she fumed. "For my birthday? That's the story of my life." Dad meant well, which probably makes it worse. To be fair, we helped choose the gift. And he was heading into a steep learning curve himself. "It was always about her having to play roles she didn't choose," Lynn says. "Minister's wife, homemaker. Dad didn't see, or didn't want to see, how miserable she was." There were times when her anger broke through. "When I was about 11 or 12, Joe says, I was being a brat about taking out the garbage. She lost it and slapped me across the face. Years later, Mum would tell me that she had done things to me that were not good for me. I was always saying, 'Huh, what are you talking about?' But I know incidents like that haunted her." Busy beetling around at floor level, we rarely noticed the forces working away in the heart and mind of the woman whose attention we competed for. The pain she felt would not truly break loose while we lived in that little pink house on 2nd Avenue. But the day was coming, nonetheless.